you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, you're very welcome to episode 57 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
Myself, Mark Totman, barrister and editor of decisus.ie.
Mark, good to see you as always. And last week, you will recall, we were joined by barrister Martin Bradley, an old pal of yours.
Yeah.
What a fascinating discussion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the whole issue of artifacts that were taken during colonial times and things that were effectively looted during wartime, you know, and they find themselves in private collections and public museums. And obviously, and sometimes, as he said, there are artifacts that have religious significance, cultural significance.
And what about your old alma mater? Answer me that one now. Trinity College and the poor,
you're not
the poor
burghers done wrong
of Inishbofin.
Well,
what about all that?
At least they gave them back.
They did give them back. But I love the fact that there was a debate prior to giving them back. And that's, well, it says you, a debate is always a good thing. We welcome discussion. Okay. And this week, we're going to do something slightly different. We always have a guest in this show. For the first time ever, we're going to proceed just the two of us.
Yeah.
Isn't that it? Mm. And you're going to tell us about a case, Griffith and Griffith from 1942, a fascinating case that you discovered many moons ago and are very interested in. And I'm really looking forward to discussing that with you, Mark. But first, we're going to take a look at some cases from the Decisus website. And we're going to start with a case involving succession law, and specifically, what should happen if an executor to a will loses the capacity to act? So it's not the actual person who made the will. Obviously, the person is now deceased. And the executor who's supposed to give effect to the deceased's wishes is no longer compos mentis. What happens?
Yeah, well, what happened in this case, this is the case of EF deceased, and it's the decision of Ms. Justice Siobhan Stack. And the family members in this case were trying to get an independent solicitor to be appointed guardian ad litem in relation to certain proceedings they wanted to bring on the basis that their sister, who was the executrix, the named executrix, had lost capacity. So there was a question mark over whether she had lost capacity or not, but the court, I think, was finally satisfied that there was a very serious issue in that regard. However, the jurisdiction of the court to appoint an independent solicitor is one that only arises in certain circumstances. And the rules of court do actually make provision for an executor who loses capacity. However, the rule in question arose under the old wardship jurisdiction. Now there is this new decision-making legislation where somebody loses capacity. And so the circuit court is the body that has the right to appoint what used to be described as a committee of wards of court. And what they do is they appoint a decision-making representative. And so what Ms. Justice Stack said, it was not appropriate where there was a question mark over capacity simply to appoint a new solicitor, that they had to go through the circuit court procedure for appointing.
Make an official appointment.
Okay.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. So the next case concerns an adoption. The child in question had been conceived and born outside of the state. Ordinarily, the Adoption Authority of Ireland is supposed to consult with the biological father of the child, obviously in relation to any adoption application. In this case, however, the father could not be identified, so there was a difficulty here.
Yeah,
this is the case of, in the matter of the proposed adoption of a minor born on a certain date, and this is a decision of one of our more recent judges, Judge Nuala Jackson.
Yeah. So, as you said, normally arising from case law going back some decades now, before an adoption order is made, they have to try and consult with the biological father. In this particular case, the mother of the child had come from another country. She said that she didn't know who the father of the child was. Clearly, because it's an extra jurisdictional matter, it wasn't within the remit of the Adoption Authority of Ireland to make inquiries in the other country. So the most appropriate thing to do in that case was simply to make an application to the High Court to dispense with the requirement to consult with the biological father.
Okay.
And the court was satisfied that this was the appropriate thing to do.
Okay, very good. And finally, we take a look at a long-running case involving illegal dumping. In this case, which went over a period of 22 years, there was alleged illegal dumping, or I think it was well established that there was illegal dumping. And there was a requirement to appoint an independent expert for the purposes of assisting the court and parties in implementing a remediation plan, obviously improving the site that had been subject to illegal dumping.
I mean, the number of decisions I've seen in relation to this particular case, and I mean, I think it's just worth quoting what Ms. Justice Humphreys said here. In the 44 years since a huge illegal dump, possibly the largest in the history of the state, began operating at a quarry site in Whitestown West in West Wicklow in about 1979, the situation has led to at least 5 sets of proceedings, 22 years of litigation, numerous judgments and decisions, of which this is the 18th. And he goes on to say later, a pessimist could rather be forgiven for hoping that all being well, we may see remediation before hitting the official Jarndyce versus Jarndyce threshold of 54 years in 2033. So this case just it's grown legs. Okay. And so what he did in relation to this particular aspect was, the last few judgments have all been to do with this issue of remediation, who's responsible for it, who's responsible for paying for it, what remediation requires. And he said, well, really, the appropriate thing to do is to get an independent expert in to oversee. And so that's the order that was made.
And I noticed the plaintiff here was called Brownfield Restoration Ireland. So the clue is in the title there, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's Brownfield Restoration Ireland and Wicklow County Council, and it's a decision of Mr. Justice Humphreys. So we're back after this short break with both of us discussing the case of Griffith and Griffith.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Okay, Mark, this is a first for us on the Fifth Court. We don't have a guest. We're going to do it. We're doing it ourselves. We're going solo here, are we?
Yeah.
Well, solo if there's two of us. I don't know whether that's a contradiction in terms. But there's a case called Griffith and Griffith, which is a decision from 1944, the year of our Lord. And it's a decision of Mr. Justice Kevin Haugh. People might have been more familiar with his son, Kevin Haugh Jr. Kevin Haugh Sr. was a former Attorney General and was one of the very few High Court judges that existed in Ireland at that time. Yeah. And he gave this decision in Griffith versus Griffith, which is a case involving nullity and family law, and it is a case that you love.
Well, it's a
now,
case...
Now, you tell me why.
Well, it's a case I first read when I was in the King's Inns, and I suppose it coincided with two things. One, I was reading Dubliners by Joyce around the same time, and I was struck with how this would have fitted reasonably comfortably as a story in Dubliners. And then also I was working, as you know, as a family researcher. So I spent a lot of my time looking at sort of birth, marriage and death records. And in more recent years, family law cases have been anonymized. But this is a case from the 1940s where we know the names of the parties. And in fact, I was able to look up the marriage certificate, which despite the fact, and I no spoilers normally, but despite the fact that there was an order of nullity, the marriage record was still on the register, which was curious. So I suppose that was of interest to me. But I thought the story was just so interesting in terms of what Irish society was like in 1925, when the events in this case took place. So I just thought maybe we might discuss it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think the comparison with the content of a Dubliner story actually is really apt in relation to this. It's kind of anyway. Let's go into it. So the year of our Lord 1925.
Yeah.
Young fella is out and he wants to go camping in Howth.
Yeah, 19-year-old boy.
Yes.
Cyril Griffith. He's apprenticed in the leather trade, and he goes on a camping holiday with a friend in Howth, and they meet a couple of young ladies, and he, for want of a better term, gets together with this girl, Margaret Hayes.
Okay, and we should say he's from Capel Street in Dublin.
Well, he lived in Eccles Street, but he was working with his father in a company called Mullen Brothers, which I think is still there, or a successor is still there, on Capel Street. And Margaret Hayes lived in Dorset Street. So, I mean, very much, North Inner City. And so what happened was three, four months after they went on this camping holiday, he's working in Mullen Brothers. And who walks in but Margaret Hayes with her mother? And it gives a verbatim account or an alleged verbatim account of what took place. Because Mrs. Hayes goes in and says, is this him? And Margaret nodded. And she then turns to Cyril and says, do you know this girl? And he says, I was with her some months ago, Mrs. Hayes. And she says, I've had this girl examined by a doctor and she is pregnant and you are the cause of it. I remember the date my daughter was in Howth. She took the liberty to go in my absence and she has never gone there without me before. And he says then, I couldn't be the father of the child, but she says it couldn't have been anybody but you. You can't make a victim out of my daughter. Now, the point is here that he's 19 years old and she's 17 years old.
Oh, will you just go back to the Howth bit again?
Okay.
Okay. So how do they go to Howth together?
No, they,
no, they met at Howth.
They met in Howth. Yeah. I don't know.
So that was the slaying of the day or,
I don't know if Howth
the
was
longitude.
A big camping.
Is it the longitude?
Longitude, oxygen, witness. I don't know.
Whatever. Anyway, electric picnic. We got another opportunity to mention the electric picnic.
I don't know if there was a music festival going on, but certainly
there was certainly tents involved.
There were tents involved, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So how do they meet on the grassy hill in Howth?
We have very little information about the meeting other than the fact that whatever took place there, she alleged gave rise to her pregnancy.
Okay.
Okay. And
there was a visit to a tent.
And without wanting to give too many spoilers, as a result of Mrs. Hayes coming into the shop, they end up getting Cyril's father involved. And he then takes Cyril to the priest, Father O'Doherty. And between them, they say, look, you've clearly wronged this girl. You're clearly the father of her child. You have to marry her. And he protests and says, no, I'm not. I don't think I could be the father of the child. They say, well, she wouldn't say this if there wasn't something to it. And so they compel him to get married to her. So they arrive at the church, St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Berkeley Road in Dublin, 18th of November 1925. They get married at 4 o'clock. They don't talk to each other beforehand. They get married. They leave separately, go back to their respective families' houses. And it's only a couple of months later that Cyril's father says, look, you're married to this girl. You really ought to be living together. And they arrange for her to move into Cyril's family house. And they set up a room for them to live together in married bliss. And it is not until February 1926 that they have their one and only act of sexual intercourse. Let's not put too fine a point on it. After which Cyril says, and this is again verbatim from the judgment, what took place now didn't take place when we were in Howth. Why have you blamed me for Howth? And Margaret admitted straight away that he was not the father of her child. And she said that she told Cyril who the real father of the child was, although the name isn't given in the judgment. And she said she had to find somebody else to be their father of the child because she said the other man knew too much about her. Now, we can only speculate why she didn't want to marry the man who was the father of the child. And I suppose in 1944, when the judgment came out, maybe they wouldn't have speculated the way we would now. But obviously, we can well imagine that this 17-year-old girl had been put in a difficult position, should we say.
Of course, And I love the fact that a central player in this is Father O'Doherty. So there had to be a Catholic priest involved. Can we go back to that initial meeting? So let's go back into the shop. I mean, the detail is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, so your man is going about his business, working away as a leather worker, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And in comes this mother and daughter, and he's immediately accused of being the father of her child that is due. She's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think we will go to the court case and the court case is very interesting, but he is repeatedly referred to as a kind of an innocent young fellow.
Yeah.
You know, and did he have any sort of opportunity to protest his innocence and to try and explain that maybe he mightn't be the father of the child?
Well, it appears that he said to his father that he didn't think he was the father of the child, and he said to the priest he didn't think he was the father of the child. But I suppose he clearly hadn't had any sexual experience beforehand, or that's the impression one has, that he, as you say, he was described as a bit of an innocent. And he clearly wasn't 100% sure. And it really wasn't until the time that he was in the family home with Margaret and said, what took place now didn't take place in Howth.
To quote Mick Jagger, let's spend the night together. And after that, he kind of said, no, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
You know, now I definitely know that I'm not the father of the child.
And she admitted straight away.
So what to do? What to do at that point?
So at that stage, he goes and he talks to his father. They go to Father O'Doherty. And again, you know, it's a reasonable detail is given because Father O'Doherty did give evidence in the court case in 1944 that she explained to him what had happened. And he then drew up a document for her to sign, which said, I, Margaret Mary Griffith, hereby state that Cyril Griffith is not and could not be the father of the child I am bearing and that the statements which I made to the effect that no one else but he could be the father of this child, which statements forced him to marry me, were knowingly false. And she signed that in the presence of Father O'Doherty and Cyril Griffith.
Okay. And if there's a person that I found kind of, I mean, you know, I'm sure all of the parties were noble in this case, but the father of Cyril, who, you know, sort of says, well, you're going to have to do right by this girl and marry her. And then after they get married, as you said, at 4 o'clock in Haddington Road, and then they both just go home.
Yeah,
that's it. They don't even, you know,
don't
go
talk
for
to each other.
A wedding breakfast or whatever you have.
No ceremony or dancing till 3 a.m.
Get a pint in across the way in the 51 or anything. So like they headed for the hills. But he was the one who said, look, you know, guys, actually, you're married here, so she should live with us.
Yeah.
But he also encouraged his son to pay her 15 shillings. A month, is that right?
I think 10 shillings a week.
A week? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Even better.
Yeah, so even though, and this is after the it was acknowledged that she had effectively misled him into to marrying her. He kept paying, exactly. And what's interesting, well, I mean, what's interesting is that he stopped paying in 1935 after they got a church annulment. So clearly the view was that while they were married in the eyes of the church, he should be paying some money towards her.
And will you explain that, Mark? Okay, so obviously annulment prior to the introduction of divorce in this jurisdiction, the only way you could effectively separate and live separate lives and get married again was if you got a civil annulment.
Yeah.
But people are more familiar with kind of ecclesiastical annulments, I think, aren't they? And the fact that, you know, the church can annul a relationship. And in this case, that came first.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's worth just reminding listeners that, you know, divorce, while it had technically been available in Ireland until independence, although I think it was only through a private act of parliament, was effectively not available after independence in that, and then it was specifically prohibited by the 1937 constitution. So, as you say, the only way to get out of a marriage was to have it annulled. Now, the term annulment can be used of almost any contract, but it has particular significance in relation to a marriage contract, because what it's effectively saying is that this marriage never took place. And in those days, the only way to really say that a marriage could be annulled in the sense of never having taken place was if somebody had effectively been compelled to get married, that somebody was not getting married of their own volition. And it's important to say, and maybe we didn't say it particularly earlier, there was a very real suggestion that if Cyril didn't marry Margaret, that he would go to jail. That because she was under the age of 18, they don't use the term rape, but the very strong suggestion is that by having had sex with her when she was 17 and unmarried, that he would be liable to a prison sentence. And he was terrified that this is what would happen to him if he didn't marry her.
Okay, so let's go to, and obviously, I mean, that was huge pressure on this young man and, you know, obviously clouded his ability to make his own decision and his own kind of free will choice. Will you go to the annulment, which took place in a Dublin diocesan court, and there was also a Roman aspect to this?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just before we get onto the sort of legal stuff, I suppose there's a couple of kind of postscripts to the story itself. One is that in May 1926, Margaret gave birth to twins who died almost immediately after birth. So, I mean, obviously, hugely tragic. But I suppose then from Cyril's point of view, there was not a child who was legally his arising from the marriage, okay, because the children didn't survive. And then the other thing that's worth mentioning is that Margaret sent two very, very sad letters to him, one in 1927 and one in 29. Remember, they got married in 25. And the one in 1927, she said, "I ask you for God's sake to try and forgive all the wrong and harm I have done you. I know it is a lot to ask, but try and to overlook it all." And then 2 years later, she writes to him and says, "My dear Cyril, I hope you will excuse this note, as you told me before not to write to you, but I want you to meet me on Monday night at the Mater Hospital at 8 o'clock. Please meet me there, as there is something I would like to ask you." And he didn't go to meet her.
So he never replied.
We never found out what.
I suppose that's understandable, Mark, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, clearly he felt very hurt and betrayed by what happened. But, you know, he was still technically married to her in the eyes of the church until 1935, when, as you say, there was an annulment proceeding before the diocesan court. Now, What the Diocesan Court found was that the marriage was invalid on the grounds of what they called defective consent. And the term that they used was a consent caused by a fear unjustly imposed. So I suppose if he had been the father of the children, it would have been a fear justly imposed, but it was unjustly imposed by virtue of the misrepresentation by her. And so the annulment then took place in 1935. So
they what been, about Father O'Doherty? Did he have a say in relation to this?
I don't think the judgment goes into his role in the Diocesan Court, but I think we can assume that he was involved because he was certainly involved then in the nullity proceedings.
Yes, I mean, the civil courts were all interested in what he had to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had him being a witness to her statement that, I acknowledge that this man is not the father of my child, and I falsely represented that fact, was sufficient in order to get a decree of nullity so he could get married again in the eyes of the church.
In 1935, yes, that's the case. And like I say, I presume that Father O'Doherty was involved in that.
So obviously he went down then the next day down to, the four courts and filed an application for a civil nullity.
No, he waited another 7 years until 1942 before he brought an application for civil nullity.
But he wasn't paying the 10 shillings every week.
No, by that stage he was out of that. And it may be, and again, we can only surmise that the church nullity was considered more important, maybe from a social point of view or whatever. And again, there is no reference in the judgment to whether or not he was looking to get married again. But by 1942, he'd have been in his late 30s.
And was he still a single lad at this stage? Do we know that?
Well, I suppose in the eyes of the state, he had to be, or he was still married, so he couldn't have got married again.
Yes, of course.
But there's no reference to any other marriage anyway in the judgment. The curious thing, though, is that despite the fact that he'd stopped paying Margaret money in 1935, when he issued his nullity proceedings in 1942, the only response that he received was an application from her to the court for the payment of alimony pendent light pending the hearing of the action.
She
put her grief behind her and appears to have
at least needed
some money.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah. So then the matter...
So the case came before Judge Kevin Hawke. Yeah, and do we know a little bit about him, Mark? Do you want to tell us a little bit? A former Attorney General, appointed to the High Court.
Yeah, I mean, you probably know as much as I do.
Yes.
I must admit,
but obviously a very senior member of the judiciary
and
a serious judge and a very impressive judge.
Mm, exactly. So the evidence in the hearing itself was given by Cyril himself and by Father O'Doherty. And apparently by two priests who had been involved in the church annulment proceedings, but we don't know anything more about them by that. And also Cyril's father, who by that stage was old enough that he couldn't give evidence in person, but he gave evidence on commission, which for listeners who aren't aware of this, is where somebody effectively goes to the bedside of a sick person and takes their testimony, which is then admitted into court as evidence. So essentially what happened then was that the court had to decide, and I think the question that was raised before the court was, whether the petitioner was induced to go through the ceremony of this alleged marriage with the respondent by such threats and duress as to make the said marriage invalid for want of real consent. I mean,
the judge was very reluctant here, wasn't he? I mean, despite the fact that the Catholic Church had given its pronouncement on it.
Yeah.
I mean, the witnesses, Father O'Doherty, if I can mention him again.
Well, I think we can safely say that marriage as an institution was considered sacred, not just in the religious sense. You know, that in those days, there was effectively no divorce in Ireland, that marriage was considered something you went into for life. And it wasn't just the church that sought to uphold this, it was the courts. And if somebody wanted to go in and say, actually, do you know what? I was forced to go through this marriage. The courts were going to take an extremely skeptical view of that. And it's clear from the tone of Mr. Justice Hawes' judgment that he took a very sceptical view. He went through quite a lot of detail to look at the distinction between a church marriage and a marriage at law. Emphasised the fact that although the two tend to take place at the same time, that they have different meanings. He looked at the distinction between divorce and nullity. He went through the law of duress and intimidation. And what he said about Cyril's evidence then was that Cyril hadn't been cross-examined, so that he had to take a certain sceptical view. He said, it is a unique and remarkable story, and if it stood by itself without reliable corroboration, told some 18 years after the ceremony, I would be bound to reject it because of its inherent improbability, and might with reason suspect that it was either the result of his own invention or a collusive narrative prepared by both parties for their mutual convenience. That, you know, he's saying that even if two people wanted to get out of a marriage, that, if they come up with a story like that, that the courts would be bound to refuse to grant the nullity.
And he did make the point that many valid marriages, you know, are entered into on the basis of a threat.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, I mean...
Should we say valid in those days?
Shotgun wedding, for example. Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean, that's entirely valid. I mean, that's a perfectly good marriage as far as Kevin Hart and Irish society was in the good old days. So the form of duress in this, it's different. I mean, there was duress in this in the sense that this young man, the poor young fella, was worried about he might have to go to jail because, you know, Margaret was 17 at the time. He was alleged to have had intercourse with her. But then there was also a lack of knowledge. I mean, he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know when he made a commitment. Yeah. He wasn't aware of the true nature of the story due to his own innocence and to, you know, suddenly being confronted with this big scenario that he had never anticipated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the central part of this is the fact that she misled him, that she knew that another man was the father of her child and that she clearly needed, in her own terms, to find somebody who was prepared to marry her and delighted on poor Cyril.
Okay, and I can understand why, you know, this is a big decision for the judge to make, you know, against the social mores of that time and contrary to, you know, established views in Irish society. But he was very resistant to, you know, the evidence, the plain evidence that wasn't contradicted. As you say, Margaret was still looking for alimony and for some financial support, but she wasn't in any way challenging the story that was being given. No. Now, he kind of addressed that by saying, oh, they could have been in cahoots, basically, where they could have come together and concocted the story for their own mutual benefit. Though it was hard to see where the mutual benefit was here, you know, for anybody, really, in this situation.
Well, the mutual benefit would be that there
they could
two
both
people
start
who,
over.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, the two of them hadn't lived together since a couple of months after they got married and might have wanted to start over.
But anyway, in terms of his conclusion, he went to the most substantial evidence of all, and that was provided by Father O'Doherty. Isn't that correct? Can I just read a quote here from the decision, Mark, which you very kindly gave to me? I have taken the view that the petitioner was a somewhat innocent young man, as stated by Father O'Doherty in his evidence, and was much influenced by his father's advice and wishes. As far as I judge by this test, he seemed a truthful and candid witness. And I believe the position was having regard to his youth and general inexperience, but overborne by the advice and suggestions of his father and Father O'Doherty, and gravely influenced and frightened by the threat of prosecution and the consequent exposure and scandal to himself and his parents, along with the fear of possible imprisonment, that he married the respondent in the belief that he was possibly, but not probably, responsible for her pregnancy. I mean, very well said by the judge. So he came around to the idea. An annulment was granted.
Exactly. And I think it's worth saying that the two letters written by Margaret and the statement that she signed in the presence of Father O'Doherty and Cyril Griffiths were very influential, that they were the corroboration that was necessary to establish Cyril's story.
Okay. Now, we recently, as you know, had a wonderful discussion with Mr. Justice Gerard Hogan about the McGee case, which kind of changed social mores in Ireland. So were they all marching on O'Connell Street after this and saying, you know, look, this poor young man had been forced into a marriage that he couldn't get out of and that we need to address that? You know, I can see the placards over O'Connell Bridge, no?
Not as such. But what is worth saying is that the concept of legal nullity became a much more important feature of Irish family law in the years after this case. Now, obviously, the misrepresentation and duress were specific to this case, but what happened after this, sort of particularly in the 60s and 70s, was that the concept developed of somebody being effectively unready for marriage, unable to enter into and sustain normal marital relations was the term that was used. So if somebody was effectively just a bit too young and immature to get married, the courts started to take a slightly rather benign view and would grant nullity in certain cases. Now, again, they would be extremely hesitant to do so, but there certainly was precedent for such cases.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a lot about this area. I mean, when I'm thinking of family law, it goes back to Paul Ward's lectures in UCD all those years ago. But I mean, there was, you know, some case law precedent in relation to the fact that people were not aware of what they're entering into.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
basically you haven't made a valid election because you don't know. And I mean, there were cases where when a couple that had previously not been intimate tried to be intimate and it didn't work out. I mean, the state looked on that favourably towards the parties and basically said, we're not going to force you to stay together.
That was a, I think there was a more long-standing rule that a marriage could be annulled if it hadn't been consummated or if, should we say, one of the parties was unable to engage in the necessary act of consummation. But it was arising from that that they started to use the term inability to enter into and sustain normal marital relations. It took a sort of a wider meaning than the straightforward kind of impotence.
Okay, so where stand we now, Mark? This has been really interesting, really, really good. Where stand we now in terms of nullity? Now we can get divorced. Do we need nullity anymore? Is it gone?
I think clearly, I suppose a few changes have happened. I mean, first of all, obviously in 1995, we had the divorce referendum. And now, you know, once you've met the criteria, you can get divorced. So nullity isn't such an issue. I am aware from colleagues that nullity is occasionally relied on, really in cases where very young people have got married and the marriage has fallen apart so quickly that they effectively say, well, look, let's see if we can treat this marriage as never having taken place rather yes. than going down the divorce route.
So, I mean, I suppose just for listeners who might not understand the distinction, if the marriage is annulled, it never happened.
Yeah, it's a way.
It's gone ab initio. It's exactly. gone.
It's a way of saying that the marriage contract never took place at law.
Whereas if you get divorced, you were married up until the point at which you got divorced.
Exactly.
And you had a valid marriage and therefore consequences might flow from that.
Yeah.
Property rights, maintenance, all that sort
yeah,
of stuff.
I mean, I suppose it's also worth saying that the distinction between being married and not being married has fallen away in a number of respects. First of all, in 1987, the concept of illegitimacy was removed at Irish law. So if a child is born outside of wedlock, that the child doesn't suffer in the way that they did previously in relation to, particularly inheritance rights. And obviously the stigma of illegitimacy really just doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. And also then the rights and duties of cohabitants legislation means that if two people are living together as if they are husband and wife without having got married, certain legal consequences kind of flow, including claims for maintenance and succession.
Okay. Well, Mark, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you for bringing this case to our attention. What's the moral of the story? Don't go camping in Howth. Is that it?
I'm sure that is what the main takeaway for our listeners. Yes, in fact, I'm not even sure if you're allowed to camp in Howth these days.
Well, Mark, I don't know. You might be a regular listener to this show, but we have this feature where we ask people to recommend a book or a movie to our listeners that they might be interested in. Any books or movies that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Funny you should mention that. There's a book which it's not primarily a legal book, but there's a book called The Power Broker by Robert Caro, which has become kind of, it was written in the 1970s about Robert Moses, who was the Parks Commissioner of New York for 40 years and effectively was responsible for almost all of the development in New York City and state for a period of about 40 years. It's suddenly become kind of fashionable again because there is a podcast in relation to the book. I read it a few years ago, and what I found particularly interesting about it was that there were two ways in which Robert Moses exercised power. One was that he had an extraordinary talent for drafting legislation in such a way that the legislators who voted on it didn't understand what they were voting on. And secondly, that a large number of the public contracts had clauses in them that said that the bondholders were the ones who had more power over the contracts than the public officials. And so whenever a public official said, we can't allow this to proceed, he'd say, yeah, but look, the bondholders are the ones who have the whip hand here. And
this book was never made into a movie, Mark, was it?
A play has been made about it, but it is an extraordinary
touché,
book.
Right back at me. Yeah, absolutely.
But I have to warn listeners, it is over 1,000 pages long, and it certainly took me about a year to read.
Great. No, very good. And what about a movie?
Let me think. Short of My Cousin Vinny and Legally Blonde, nothing is leaping to mind.
Can I just jump
in?
I'm probably out of order here. I'm breaking the sequence here. But nobody has ever mentioned my favourite legal movie, which is a movie called Music Box from 1989, Costa Gravis. I was in Berlin at the time, and it won the Golden Bear Award. And it's an incredible story about a lawyer played by Jessica Lange, if people remember her, fabulous actress, who's defending her father, who's accused of Nazi war crimes. Okay. So if any of our listeners out there want to check out Music Box, love to get some reaction. Do people agree with me? It is fantastic courtroom drama. So there you go. Anyway, Mark, thank you for this. And thank you for bringing the case of Griffith versus Griffith to our attention. It's been really interesting.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
Well, that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. And Mark, I hope you enjoyed our little discussion there about Griffith and Griffith.
I did. Well, as you know, it's a case I've read a long time ago and I just keep coming back to it because I think it's just such an interesting set of facts.
I thought it was great. Well done. Before we go, I would like to say a big thank you to our producer, Cunnel O'Moroyne, and to Lee Brennan of the Dublin South Podcast Studios for their wonderful work in recording this show. So for me, Peter Leonard.
Myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.